Case versus Broadnax, Mr. Stevens.
May it please the court. I would like to discuss all three issues that I've raised in the brief. So I will first start with the question of the concurrent or consecutive sentence issue. And I think at the heart of that is a question of whether the conduct which led to the state probation violation and the state sentence can be counted as relevant conduct in the federal case. Mr. Broadnax was on the streets of South Bend at the time he was arrested for the conduct that led to the conviction here. It is true that the state court had already filed a probation violation, but he was at liberty.
But Mr. Stevens, at least the government asserts that Mr. Broadnax's offense level was just based on the 27.5 grams of cocaine he was charged with when he was arrested for this offense. And as I see 5G1.3b, it would have to be both relevant conduct and the basis for the offense level. So doesn't the guideline itself fail to support you?
I think that the guideline talks about relevant conduct that where
you need two things. It's in the conjunctive. You need it to be both relevant conduct and the basis for an increase in the offense level. And the government argues, at least, maybe they're wrong, and you know, maybe you should tell me if they are. But they say the offense level just was based on it's about an ounce, you know, of cocaine that he was caught with.
Increase.
I have to say, philosophically, it seems to me that if you're dealing with a probation revocation and now you're actually going to serve the time for the earlier state offense because you did something that caused probation to be warranted, I'm not sure what's so awful about a consecutive sentence anyway within the discretion of the district court judge. Maybe you might want to address that.
It may not be awful, but the question is whether there would be an entitlement to concurrent sentences under all of the facts and circumstances. And certainly there's overlapping conduct between what was ultimately adjudicated as the probation violation.
But where post-Booker do you find an entitlement to concurrent sentences? It would seem to me at the most you would be trying to argue that the guidelines advise concurrent sentences. I don't think they do, but there's no entitlement.
No, I wouldn't say entitlement to consideration of concurrent sentences. I think that's a better way to put it.
Okay.
But I think where the increase comes it is because it's not simply the guideline conduct, but it's the mandatory minimum that increases it above the guidelines, and that the way that the sentence actually served could be coextensive with the guideline sentence would be to give him credit for the part of the state court sentence that he didn't get credit for because the sentences were consecutive. I think that's where the increase occurs and where you're above the 110 months that is the low end of the guideline range.
Well, yeah, but you're relying on Ross, and I just don't see this case as similar enough to Ross. He was serving a sentence for a different crime. Yes, he loses his probation because of something that satisfies half of the 5G1.3b test, but not the other half, and because it doesn't affect his offense level. And he has two different crimes, two different sentences.
The offense level is affected by the mandatory minimum, which is invoked, and he could get concurrent credit for the two of them, which I think brings it within the aegis of the guidelines. But you know, if you read Ross another way, I can't stop you. Let me move on to the speedy trial point. I think the cases that the government cites are all post-trial cases. We raised the speedy trial point mid-trial. And the question, I think, fundamentally is whether you waive a speedy trial point if it's raised before the conclusion of the trial.
Well, of course, jeopardy has attached at the point you raised it.
That's true.
Which would be one reason to say you really need to raise it before the trial starts.
Unless you determine that the violation has occurred and that really ought to result in complete termination of the proceedings.
But that's rarely the proper remedy for a Speedy Trial Act violation. It's dismissal without prejudice. It's not right.
And maybe that's the answer, to say that since you made the motion for seeking speedy trial, you've waived your double jeopardy point. I mean, that certainly would be an answer to it.
Well, you could waive it expressly anyway if you wanted. Right.
I don't think that solves the question of whether the motion made mid-trial is too late.
No, but I think it would be too late if the consequence were double jeopardy. But I suppose you could always say, well, we're making this motion's belated, but we waive any subsequent double jeopardy complaint if there's a further...
The remedy certainly could be, at this point, to say that the indictment is dismissed without prejudice, because that is one of the remedies that the statute provides.
There are reasons for wanting these motions to be made promptly, right? You don't want to go to the end of a, might be a long trial, and say, oh, by the way, like another trial. So you pull out of your back pocket your speedy trial claim and say, oh, I want another trial. That wouldn't do.
This certainly was not a long trial. And the motion for dismissal is always made after the violation has occurred. So, I mean, in that sense, I don't think that there's any prejudice from it. But I do point out that, as far as I can tell, this is the only case that I am aware of where it was raised in not post-trial, but in the context of...
Well, I don't know why you're arguing that distinction, though. The statute itself requires the motion to be brought prior to trial, so I don't know how during trial satisfies that requirement and why there's a distinction between during trial and after trial when the statute says prior to trial.
I think that statute can be read as prior to the conclusion of the trial.
Well, what is the violation that occurs during the trial? I mean, the speedy trial is, for the start of the trial. So how does a violation occur during the trial?
The violation has already occurred because the time has elapsed.
But you were saying you don't have to make the motion until the violation has occurred. And I thought you said the violation occurred during the trial.
The violation occurred sometime in the November proceeding, the trial. I see my time is up.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Stevens. Mr. Barrett?
May it please the Court, as to the first issue regarding the consecutive versus concurrent sentences, I think it's clear from the guidelines from Section 5G1.3 that this is not an instance in which the guidelines contemplate a concurrent sentence. The probation revocation was a revocation of a sentence that had been imposed from a prior case in 2004. The federal case was from conduct occurring in 2006. They are entirely separate events. And the while the federal arrest may have been the genesis of that revocation, in no way does the prior conduct constitute relevant conduct in this case. So as Your Honors pointed out, I think that the one of the two conjunctive elements of 5G1.3b certainly is not met here. In addition, in our brief, we cite the application note, which, while obviously not binding on the court, recommends that in cases where there is a probation revocation because of the instant federal offense, in those cases, the sentence for the revocation should be consecutive to the concurrent sentence, to the federal sentence. So not only does 5G1.3b not apply, but there's an application note under Section 5G1.3c, which explicitly recommends the treatment that Judge Sharp gave the sentence in this case. As to the Speedy Trial Act, there are any number of reasons, some of which the court has mentioned, that a Speedy Trial Act claim should be brought prior to trial, as the statute says. While Mr. Stevens is correct, I haven't found any reported cases in which you had a decision based on a motion brought during trial. I think that probably speaks to the fact that everyone recognizes these should be brought before trial. And indeed, the Alvarez opinion from this court, albeit in dicta, explicitly speaks to being made prior to the commencement of trial. So it explicitly addresses the issue which Mr. Stevens raises. As to the third issue, which Mr. Stevens didn't address in his argument, the question of the sufficiency of the court's voir dire, here, again, we believe Mr. Stevens has waived or, in the alternative, forfeited that argument. A list of 44 questions, proposed voir dire questions, were submitted before trial, including questions such as what the jurors' favorite colors are or what bumper stickers they have on their car. During the entire course of voir dire, Mr. Stevens never requested the particular questions which he asked for after voir dire was completed. So while he obviously asked for them in his pretrial filing, the notion that now it's when he didn't address them at voir dire to the court, didn't ask for them to be made, that now he can pick and choose which ones should have been made, I think sort of flies in the face of the way voir dire should operate, and I think waiver would appropriately apply there.
Okay.
Unless the court has any questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Stevens, how much time does he have? 1 minute. Do you have anything further, Mr. Stevens?
And the question of the voir dire, this was a drug case, and drug abuse was not touched upon in any way in the court's voir dire, and that was that the issues were questions about drug use, drug addiction, and recovery and attitudes of jurors toward drug enforcement policy dominated the list of questions, and they simply weren't touched on. And I think that's it's important information that we were entitled to have.